There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Tidwell, who is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of the book, The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And of course, you've just experienced one. It made landfall a little, I guess, to the north of you on the Jersey Shore. But presumably, you experienced it there in the Chesapeake.
Yes, it was a big hurricane, very big. Here in the D.C. area, for 36 hours, it sounded like a train in the distance. I mean, there was so much wind, so much roaring of wind, but the worst of it was to the north of us. It was just a massive storm, as you know, 1,000-mile diameter for the wind field, lowest barometric pressure of any hurricane to come onshore in the United States that far north. It was a monster.
So you've been at it for a while here in terms of trying to get public awareness to the problem of global warming, and you've written the book The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And I'm curious to know how much, in terms of the climate wars, the insurance companies are going to, since they've got skin in the game, whether they're going to get more politically active. We know that on the global warming denial side, you have the oil companies and the coal companies, and they effectively have the Republican Party in their pocket and a lot of coal and oil state Democrats as well. But, you know, insurance companies have got considerable resources too. So what's your sense of how this battle is going to play out long term? Because, you know, you got politicians today denying the reality of global warming, but, they can't keep denying it because the reality is just going to keep coming back and biting us.
Well, you know, speaking of politicians and climate change, during the presidential debates, neither candidate, Romney or Obama, spoke about climate change. And unfortunately for them, I guess, the climate decided to speak to them. And I think that that's what we've seen with Sandy. The fingerprints of global warming are all over this storm. I mean, it is unusual for hurricanes to strike the United States, even in Florida, this late in October, much less this far north. It's the weather equivalent of like snow in Saudi Arabia, what we've just seen with this hurricane almost on the eve of November, striking New Jersey. It's sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic of 5 degrees above normal. We could just go on and on. And climate scientists tell us this is precisely the kind of storm, and if it's precisely in the pattern of climate change that we've seen recently. The insurance companies are being more vocal. What's really tragic about the insurance companies, however, is they've been more and more sounding the alarm about climate change is happening, extreme weather is increasing. My home in Tacoma Park, Maryland, is insured by Travelers, and I got a flyer a month ago. I got a letter with this flyer on it showing a house about to be hit by a tornado and with storm clouds over the top. And Travelers sent this to me by way of telling me that my policy premium was going up because of extreme weather. And then in the fine print at the bottom, they cited scientific studies saying that the extreme weather was driven by global warming. The tragic thing about the insurance companies, yes, they have skin in the game. Yes, they're affected by this extreme weather, but they're reluctant, very reluctant to say what's causing it. And that's because the insurance companies, they don't make their money off premiums. That's not how they make most of their money. They make their money by investing your premiums in the stock market and making money that way. And they invest a lot in fossil fuels. So you have this conspiracy of silence almost among insurance companies as to the why of global warming, but they are getting more and more noisy about the what. And that alone, just the insurance company sounding the alarm that extreme weather is increasing, should be enough to move us further down the path of solutions.
So insurance, of course, is a state matter controlled by state regulators. Do you think, though, that we could get to a situation, because the Travelers pamphlet that you referred to, Mike Tidwell, the data was compiled by the German reinsurance giant Munich Re, and they have a scientific footnote to it, saying that in all likelihood, we have to regard this finding as an initial climate change footprint in our U.S. loss data from the past four decades. Previously, there has not been such a strong chain of evidence. So you say correctly that in the bottom of the fly that you got from Travelers, they acknowledged climate change and the reality of climate change. I'm just wondering what will happen, though, when you got politically appointed state insurance officials and insurance companies going to them and saying, we've got to increase our premiums because of global warming. And these politically appointed state insurance officials, particularly in the red states, will be saying, no, global warming doesn't exist. It's a fraud. So what happens then? I mean, I know it's not necessarily your expertise, but I'm just curious about how this argument is going to pan out in the future.
First of all, the U.S. insurance industry and likely the global insurance industry will not survive in its present form under climate change. There's almost no way that it will. There's going to be the extreme weather is continuing. The losses pile up. I mean, this Hurricane Sandy alone is probably going to be about $50 billion in total losses, if not more. These things are just going to accelerate. There's going to come a point where the insurance industry is going to recognize that they cannot survive unless there is a stabilization of the climate, unless we switch to clean energy and off of coal, oil, and natural gas fast enough to slow down these extreme weather events. That moment is going to come. I predict that it's going to come pretty soon. And when the insurance companies finally get political, finally put their shoulder into sounding the alarm, I think that we may have a narrow window of time where we could still pull off a sort of global climate stabilization, because they are very powerful, and they may find resistance from Republicans, but there's just going to come a point where Travelers Insurance is pointing to ExxonMobil and saying, you're putting us out of business. You know, Travelers is going to point to Peabody Coal and say, you are killing our shareholders. And that's just going to happen. And, you know, Big Ag is going to do the same thing. I mean, the major wheat and corn growers in the Midwest are going to start pointing to the coal industry and saying, you're killing our business. It's taken so long to get to that point. You wonder if we still have enough time.
So, Mike Tidwell is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of the book, The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. And we're talking about the cost of this storm, this superstorm Sandy, that's by no means over. The estimates are as high as $50 billion. In costs. This follows Irene, which had $10 billion in insurance losses. And then you go back to Katrina, which had some $500 billion in insured losses. $125 billion in losses. And then the nuclear meltdown in Japan recently, I believe that was up to $40 billion in losses. You just begin to sort of wonder how, you know, these losses are coming more frequently, how the system can cope with it.
Yes, and one of the things that, you know, I write in an article I did for The Nation magazine this week, I point out that, you know, in terms of our coastal communities, you know, Hurricane Sandy has just revealed how vulnerable New York is. New York is very similar to New Orleans in that much of the city is below sea level. Much of New York is literally below ground, the subway, the tunnels, the parking garages, the cellars, the basements. So much of New York is below sea level, and we've seen what happens when a surge comes into lower Manhattan and comes over the banks of the Hudson and East Rivers, and there's just going to be more of that with climate change as the oceans rise and hurricanes get bigger. So, you know, we have three choices, really. We can retreat from most of our coastal areas inland, and that's not anyone's preference, obviously. Number two, we can adapt and just try to endure, you know, adapt to life in this higher seas and bigger storms. Or three, we can make a very rapid switch to non-carbon-based energy, hopefully in time to stabilize the climate. You know, we're not gonna retreat, at least not as a first course. We're probably gonna do a combination of two and three. We're going to adapt and rapidly switch to clean energy, one hopes, very soon. But in terms of adaptation, that essentially means in New York, we're gonna have to build levees. We're gonna have to build floodgates. Washington, D.C. on the Potomac is gonna need a floodgate. Baltimore on the Patapsco River, parts of Charleston. We're going to have to live behind levees just like New Orleans now. And that is a scary, terrifying prospect, but it's one that we've created for ourselves because we've been so slow to respond to the threat of global warming. So I think it's inevitable, Ian, that you're going to see and very soon, I think not long after we finally get past the humanitarian crisis phase of Sandy, you're going to see what previously would have been scarcely credible conversations about building levees in parts of New Jersey and New York, and again, a floodgate similar to what is now on the Thames River that protects London from surge tides. You're going to see that in the East Coast of the United States, and it's going to be a form of adaptation to climate change, but it's so risky. But this is what the East Coast is going to look like.
Again, Mike Tidwell, who is the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of the book The Ravaging Tide, which is about global warming and hurricanes. He also has an article at The Nation. We are all from New Orleans now. Mike, this is this going to permeate, though, this reality? Is it going to permeate the last few days of this presidential debate? As we mentioned earlier, neither candidate has talked about it, although Obama did talk about it on MTV. They've clearly avoided it in their three debates. Is there any way in the last minute that either side can capitalize on it? I mean, you've got Romney today refusing to even talk about his policy of throwing FEMA back to the states. He just simply refused to comment on his own policy. Is Obama like to say something, do you think?
You know, I don't know. The three presidential debates that we watched, it's important to understand that conversation that Romney and Obama were having about energy was purchased by the fossil fuel corporations. I mean, they've given so much money to both campaigns and to politicians throughout Congress and throughout the state capitals. They've spent hundreds of millions of dollars to make sure they strike fear in the heart of anyone who really campaigns hard on climate change and tells the truth about their dirty energy, that we shouldn't be surprised that those debates were minus any reference to climate change. It's tragic. It's terrible. But again, they refuse to talk about it, but the climate has decided here at the last minute to speak to them. And again, the fingerprints of global warming are all over Sandy. Whether the president can bring, certainly Romney will never, he acknowledges that the planet is warming, but he refuses to express an opinion as to what's causing it, which is obviously ridiculous and anti-science to its core. The president, on the other hand, my guess is he's unlikely to come clean on climate change, although he's surrounded by many advisors, many of whom I know, who are telling him you need to speak more about this, and who swear to activists that the president does get it, but that the number one thing he needs to do is get reelected. They remind us constantly if Romney becomes president, he will dismantle the EPA. He will appoint you know, at least one or two justices to the Supreme Court, and we'll be, you know, nowhere close to getting a price on carbon fuels for the next generation. So that's the argument that Obama's people make for being reticent on the issue of climate change, but it's not good enough. And I think that, you know, writers and activists like Bill McKibben and others have been campaigning hard. There's a Bill McKibben's going on a nationwide tour called Do the Math Tour that shows just how much carbon is still in the ground worldwide in oil, coal, and natural gas, and just how much carbon the fossil fuel companies intend by their own business models, their own announced design, intend to bring up and set on fire, five times more than the climate can possibly tolerate. So the ExxonMobil and the coal companies and Chevron, they intend to complete the catastrophic warming of the planet. That is their intention, their public intention to do that. But if you do the math, and that's part of this nationwide tour, and you can Google it, Do the Math, Bill McKibben and his group 350.org, you can see Bill and myself and others who are going to be talking about this Do the Math and trying to bring this issue to whichever administration takes over after the election.
Well, just in closing, Mike Tedwell, I'm not aware that my understanding is that in 2010, the biggest donors to the Republicans when they surprised everybody and took over the House that were oil and gas. The huge investments in oil from oil and gas in 2010, orchestrated by Karl Rove and others. My understanding in this race that 99% of the money is going to Romney, and that in coal country, Obama is being painted as the enemy of coal, even if he keep talking about clean coal, which is a myth. So I'm not aware that Obama's getting any money from oil and coal, is he? I mean, nothing like what Romney's getting.
No, the American Petroleum Institute, for example, gives an overwhelming share of its donations to the Republicans and to Mitt Romney, but they do donate to Democrats. You know, there are many polluters all over the country, coal extraction companies, utilities that are addicted to coal, that give lots of money to Democrats. So, you know, there's a reason why the Democrats are, many of the centrist Democrats won't talk about climate change, and much of that is because they fear the money given to their opponents, and they need the money given to them by the fossil fuel companies. You know, the fossil fuel companies spread their money around, but you're right, the Republicans get a huge share of it. Chevron, the oil company Chevron, just gave $2.5 million to Romney 3 days ago, which is the largest single corporate donation given since the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court. So that's very revealing and explains a lot about Governor Romney's position on climate change.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mike Tedwell.
Thank you so much, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Tedwell, who's the director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and the author of The Ravaging Tide, a book about global warming and hurricanes. He has an article at The Nation, We Are All New Orleans Now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and the land you run the free. One time, one night.